All right, everyone, welcome back. This is the very last lecture in the series of the history of the English language. And today we're going to be talking about, well, basically everything. I'm going to give you a brief overview of the key points. Now, since I noticed that there are noticeably more people here today than there have been in previous weeks, let me warn you, I'm not going to be covering everything you need to know. Right? That was the point of the previous, nine lectures. So make sure that you watch those. You can catch up online. They're all available. But today should just give you an idea of what the big picture looks like and about some of the general things that I hope you'll take away from this course, regardless of how well you do in the exam. But I'm also going to give you plenty of opportunities to ask questions. And I know you're not hugely fond of doing this, but you can. This is your last chance to overcome your natural urge to be silent and to raise your hand loud and proud if you have a question to ask. So please do so at any point, and I will try and look around and pause and give you an answer to the best of my ability. Just as a reminder, the exam is next week, and the exam will start on the dot of 10 o'clock. So I want you to be here already in your seats by 10 o'clock, and on the dot of 10 we will begin the exam. Just so that you know, if you arrive late, I can't guarantee that you will be able to take the exam, so make sure that you don't. One other quick thing, make sure you bring some sort of ID, so ideally your student card, and we'll be checking them throughout the exam. And when you come and sit down next Monday, try and spread yourself out a bit so there's a good bit of space between you and the next person. You will definitely need to take up more of the hall than you usually take so that you can sit a little bit apart from one another. Good, then we'll go on. One last thing before we start, and that is the answer sheet to the practice exam has now been uploaded to Ilias. So if you've had a look at the practice exam and you want to test yourself on that, you can do that using what's been provided on Ilias. All right, so today we're going to cover some of the big picture topics that we have talked about throughout the course. We're going to bring them back and take stock. And those are largely questions about the regularity of sound change, questions about the language changing from synthetic to analytic, the process of grammaticalization, the effects of language contact between English and other languages, and the effects and the social status of prescriptivism in the history of the language. And then we'll round off with some general revision. First and foremost, I think if you've got this far, you should be proud of yourselves, because you can now, I'm not going to say you can effortlessly read any English text ever been written, that's not the point. The point is that you now know how to, if you wanted to, and you could use the tools that are available to you, the dictionaries, the grammars, the tools that will allow you to access any text written in the history of the language. So that is already quite an achievement in itself. There's a vast amount of material that is now accessible to you that might not have been before. But beyond that, you now have some historical context as to where our present-day English language comes from. And there's quite a contrast here, because usually when people talk about the history of England, of the English language, they very rarely go back past 1066. So in particular, the origin of the English language in Anglo-Saxons coming to England, to the British Isles during the 5th century, is something that is now in your heads, or at least should be. And taking another step back, we can also say that hopefully you have a deeper understanding now of some of the factors that drive language change. And these are factors that drive language change not only in English, but in all of the languages of the world. So we can broadly divide these up into internal factors, which are factors that have to do with individual speakers, their usage, their cognitive abilities, their acquisition of the language, on the one hand. And on the other hand, external factors that have to do with the social history of the language. So we can divide between the internal factors, which are things like the regular sound change that we've seen, and grammaticalization. And external factors are things like language contact, by which, as I've tried to emphasize throughout the course, we really mean speakers coming into contact, users of the language, learners of the language coming into contact with each other, and also prescriptivism, which involves attitudes to a crucial degree. So where did we start? We started from Proto-Indo-European, going way back, at least two steps beyond English itself. We've got English down here in the bottom left-hand corner, and you can go up the tree, and that takes you to Old English, which is a West Germanic language. West Germanic languages are Germanic languages, and the Germanic languages can be divided into North, West, and East. And at the higher level, the Germanic languages belong to the Indo-European language family, of which the mother language is called Proto-Indo-European. And within that Indo-European language family are all of the languages that we've talked about on this course. So not only English itself, but also we've talked about the Anglo-Norse language, the Scandinavian language, which is a North Germanic language. We've talked about French, which is in here the Italic branch of languages, descending from Latin, and we've got a little bit further up there the Celtic branch of languages, which have also had an appreciable impact on the history of the English language. So all of these languages that we've discussed are ultimately related, although most of them are related only quite distantly. As regards the regularity of sound change, this is what we covered right at the start of the course. So what we saw here was that English shows systematic sound correspondences with other Germanic and Indo-European languages. Crucially, Grimm's law is the main change, the most noticeable change, that sets the Germanic languages off from the other Indo-European languages. So Germanic f, and h, the fricatives, correspond in the general case to Latin p, t, and k. So a Latin word like pater, for father, all of the Germanic languages have a f. So for instance, German Vater, spelt with a V, but don't let that confuse you. It's clearly a voiceless fricative. You don't say Vater. Dutch Vader, similarly, English Father, versus the Latin word Pater and Greek words like the ones that give rise to, for instance, patriarch, patriarchy. Those also involve the root for father with a P. So these P's elsewhere in Indo-European correspond to our F's in Germanic. And that's what we covered right at the start of the course. That's one of the surefire ways for distinguishing the Germanic languages from all of the others. Why do we find these sound correspondences? And why do we find them not only in individual words, but across all words that are of sufficient age? We find them because sound change is regular. And that means that when we look at the change of the form of words, it's basically not the words that change at all, it's the sounds that make them up. So rather than talking about Vater and fish and all of these words changing in parallel, it makes more sense to talk about the sound p changing into the sound f. And that's what we've done on this course. Now, when a sound change occurs in a language, all sounds of that type will be affected, and that will happen regardless of what word or morpheme they occur in. So the regularity of sound change is a very powerful process, also a very prevalent process, because again, this isn't just something that characterizes the history of English, this is something that characterizes the history of all known languages. A really striking empirical finding of linguistics in the 19th and 20th century. So the second big topic that has accompanied us throughout the history of the language is this change from synthetic to analytic. And you might remember, a synthetic language is one in which grammatical relations and other semantic features are marked not by extra words, but by morphological endings. So case is a marker of a synthetic language. Subject-verb agreement in a rich form is a marker of a synthetic language. And a classic example of a synthetic language is Navajo. In fact, many of the languages, the native languages of America, are polysynthetic, which essentially is a special word for extremely, extremely synthetic
languages.
But other languages that fall into the general remit of synthetic include some of the ones that we've briefly talked about on this course. Sanskrit is one of them. Latin is also a relatively synthetic language, though not quite as much as Sanskrit, and so on. On the other hand, you've got analytic languages, and in analytic languages, these grammatical relations, these same semantic relations, semantic features, are marked by word order. So how do you know what the subject is in a modern English sentence? Well, you know it comes before the verb, so that's how you know. How do you know what the object is? It comes after the verb. Other languages do that by means of case. That's what the synthetic languages would do. A more analytic language will do this purely in terms of word order, but also in terms of grammatical words. So rather than having a dative case in English, for instance, we would use the to preposition. I gave the book to my friend to mark that particular shade of meaning. So the use of these little words, these grammatical words like prepositions and pronouns, is another characteristic feature of our analytic languages. And a classic example of an analytic language, albeit not one that we've covered at all in this course, is Mandarin Chinese. And English, modern day English, is a very analytic language too. In fact, it's become more so over its history, and that is the point. So English has transitioned from a more synthetic language to a more analytic language. Here's what we saw last time as an illustration of this process. So in Sanskrit, you can say the sentence, he goes from the city to the forest. You see, that's 8 words in English. You can do that in just 3 words in Sanskrit. You say city, marked in the ablative case, forest, marked in the accusative case, goes, with third person singular marking on it. You don't need the pronoun because the third person singular morpheme is doing the work. You don't need the accusative case marker, you don't need the preposition to because the accusative case marker is doing the word, and you don't need the preposition from because the ablative case marker is doing the word. So this is what a really synthetic language looks like. And you can see Old English looks a little bit like this. Though Old English was never as synthetic, at least in the records that we have, it was never as synthetic as Sanskrit. Hindi Urdu, you can see this is a descendant of Sanskrit, and you can see the change. So here we've got 7 words already. He, city from, forest to, go, be. So he is gone from the city to the forest. You've got the prepositions coming in, and the case has been lost here. And also, the pronoun here, wo, meaning he, is used. So you can see the change here from synthetic to analytic, as illustrated in another language family. And in fact, this change from synthetic to analytic is something that happens in many, many branches of the Indo-European language family, to different extents. So this is a branch, the Sanskrit and Hindi-Urdu are Indo-European languages. That, in fact, was one of the most striking discoveries of actually 17th, 18th century, 19th century linguistics. Then here we've got the Germanic languages, which all become more analytic, though some of them become a lot more analytic, like English. Some of them become a little bit more analytic, like German. And you've got other families that do the same. So in the transition from Latin to the Romance languages, you also get this transition from synthetic to analytic. And if you want to find out more about that, you can go and talk to Professor Georg Kaiser, and he can tell you about that for hours. I'm sure he would greatly enjoy doing so. That's the change from synthetic to analytic. How does that cash out in the history of English specifically then? Well, here's some of the changes that actually illustrate this transition from synthetic to analytic. First of all, we had a full case system. We had case marking in nouns. We had case marking in adjectives. All of that disappears, and it disappears during the Middle English period. So by the time of the present day language, we still have case, but we only have distinctive case marking in pronouns. Everywhere else, all across these nouns and these adjectives, it's gone. So that's a huge change, huge typological change in the history of the English language. One that doesn't happen in German, for instance. We also get more use of prepositions. Well, that's to be expected from what we've seen already. So we get use of prepositions like of instead of genitive case, prepositions like to instead of dative case, and so on. We also get some verbal agreement with the subject being heavily simplified. So verbal agreement with it in present-day English, when you look at the normal lexical verb, the only remnant of verbal agreement is the S in the third person singular. So an example like, he sings. That's the only place where the subject bothers to agree with, where the verb bothers to agree with the subject at all. Everywhere else, you just have this unmarked form that looks just like the infinitive form. I sing, they sing, we sing, you sing. No morphological marking. So the subject-verb agreement paradigm in present-day English is almost dead, and in some varieties, that leveling process has gone even further. We also see more use of modals and auxiliaries. In the earlier stages of the language, you get more shades of meaning being transmitted by, for instance, the subjunctive mood, which is also, as we've seen, moribund in the present-day English language. So we see more modals, we see more auxiliaries, and that leads to a state of affairs in the present-day language where you can construct long sequences of auxiliaries like, we might have been being seen. We might have been being seen, where you have no fewer than four auxiliary elements. You've got might, a modal, have, a perfect auxiliary, been, a progressive auxiliary, being, a passive auxiliary, and then the lexical verb. So that is a major change. We see expression of the subject becoming obligatory. So you might remember, in Old English, you could leave subject out. Most of the time, in Old English, the referential subjects, so subjects that referred to people or things in the world, had to be expressed by pronouns, but the non-referential subjects, such as the subject in modern day, it is raining, or the subject in modern day, it seems that this chalk is white, so on and so forth, these its were not obligatory. And that's something that changes. Again, mostly during the Middle English period, we get obligatorification of the subject. And now, English is a language that loves its subjects very, very much. And you can barely hear a sentence of English that doesn't contain an overt subject. Word order in the meantime becomes less flexible. You can see, again, sometimes people describe Old English as having free word order, as in any combination of words is okay. We've seen that's not true. Old English word order is governed. Most importantly, Old English word order is governed by some variant on the verb second rule. So that's an important one to revise. But the Old English word order does not, is certainly more flexible than the word order in present day English. So there's a lot more that you can do in terms of moving things around in the sentence, mixing things up, than you can today. These days, again, it's rare to find an English sentence that isn't SVO, subject, verb, object. Again, there are exceptions. So the synthetic to analytic thing is a trend, it's a tendency, it's not something hard and fast. So you can have a sentence like, what do you think of various teams' performance in the World Cup this year? And then you can say, England, I find very impressive. Germany, I am not impressed by, for instance. Just to take a purely hypothetical example. So here we've got a case of objects being expressed in initial position, right? And that is something that we can still do in the present day language. This is an OSV word order. And this we can see even in the present-day language. So there is still some word order flexibility left in present-day English. And there were some rules in Old English. But as a tendency, it's true that word order becomes less flexible. You also get comparatives with more or most replacing the ones with and est. So here you've got comparatives like intelligenter, getting replaced by more intelligent, most intelligent. You probably know the rule that governs these in the present-day language. With monosyllables, you can use and est. So, for instance, fast, faster, fastest. With two-syllable words, there is some variation. So you can say stupid, stupider, stupidest, or you can say more stupid or most stupid. And then with anything more than two syllables, you tend to use more and most, rather than the morphological inflections. So that's an overview of this big change, this change from synthetic to analytic, in terms of what happens. Now, the elephant in the room at this stage is why? Why do we have this massive change? Why do we have this change that seems to change the entire typological profile of the language? And how does this continue across 1,000 years? When you think about the way that languages work, that's remarkable. Before we've mentioned, languages live in people's heads, right? That's where they live. People live nowadays for maybe 80 years, if they have a good run, 90. But this change from synthetic to analytic has been going on for over 1,000. So that means many, many generations, and especially when you consider that life expectancy has not always been as high as it is today, huge numbers of generations of speakers have carried on this same trend in the same direction. We might want to ask why. Why did this huge development take place? Well, one way of putting it is maybe the stress shift is what caused it. Why would the stress shift cause a change from synthetic to analytic? Well, you could look at it this way. In Proto-Indo-European, where the stress was flexible, there were a lot of endings. In Germanic, the stress shifts to the first syllable. So remember, again, that's one of the changes that sets the Germanic languages apart from the other Indo-European languages. The stress shifts to the first syllable. And when the stress shifts to the first syllable, that leaves all of these endings completely unstressed. And you might think, well, unstressed endings over time could just fade away. Maybe that's what happened in the history of English. The stress shift that happened at the very, very earliest point in the history of the Germanic languages caused the endings to kind of decline in importance because they weren't stressed, they would gradually become eroded over time. You can think of this as like a geological process. They get worn away because they are used and they get used less unless they get worn down, ground down. That could be part of the explanation, but it can't be the whole explanation because the stress shift applies just as much to German as it does to English, and as we've seen, English has become much more analytic than German has. So why did English go further towards analytic than German did? Here, one of the potential explanations is language contact. We know that one thing that was very important in the development of English was that it came into contact with several languages successively. So in the earliest days, we had very large-scale contact with speakers of Celtic. In all likelihood, those speakers of Celtic languages were learning English. They were learning it as a second language. And that has certain effects when people learn things as second languages. For a start, they tend to find endings very difficult to learn. Adults especially have difficulty learning endings. So that might be one of the reasons, all of these Celts learning English. Later in the history of the language, we get contact with Scandinavians. We get the Vikings, we get settlements from Scandinavians in the east and the north of the country. And again, to some level, these people would have had to communicate with each other, which again often means that you drop off endings to make yourself more easily understood. And eventually, the Norse speakers would have to shift to speaking English. And again, what happens when people do that is that they tend to leave off endings. So maybe it's these contact situations that are really fatal for the history of the endings in English. And if you're interested in this kind of question, I very much recommend this book by Peter Trudgill. And here, Trudgill gives an overview of the history of English, and he has a very particular theory of why the endings were lost. You have to approach it something like a murder mystery, right? The endings in the English language have been killed, and you have to figure out who did it. And I'm not going to spoil the ending of the story for you. For that, you can have a look at the book. Or, if you like, and here's a plug for my She3 course, you can come and take my course, Anglo-Saxons, Celts, and Vikings, which runs most summer semesters. And in that, we address some of these issues of language contact in the early history of the language in more detail. Okay, caveats. This I've already done, so I don't need to dwell on this. But we know that Old English was not a completely synthetic language. We only had four cases, so there was a vestigial instrumental case. The instrumental case was almost dead by the time of our Old English texts. We basically only have nominative, accusative, genitive, and dative, same as we do in modern German. We also have a fairly restricted word order in many respects. So, for instance, with regard to verb second, also in the nominal domain, when you look at noun phrases, they have very much the same order as noun phrases have today. We see referential subjects being expressed pretty much always in the earliest days, and we already see that verbs do not have person agreement in the plural. So the change towards analytic has already begun in the Old English period. And modern English is not a completely analytic language. So here we have a topicalization example of the kind that I used earlier on. We also see the development of certain contractions. So we see, for instance, over time, will not develops into willn't, which develops into won't. And here we're dealing with an inflectional negative ending, nt, rather than some sort of free word or eclitic. And so we actually see that the language, in certain respects, is developing towards syntheticity again. But overall, the tendency is robust that Old English is more synthetic, modern English is less synthetic, and the trend over the history of the language is from synthetic to analytic. We've also seen a few instances of this process of grammaticalization. Grammaticalization is simply a process. It's a long word for a fairly simple phenomenon. Lexical words become more grammatical. By lexical words, we're thinking of things like nouns, verbs, words which have independent, clear, conceptual meaning, and they become functional words, words which have a grammatical role, words which function as the glue that binds sentences together. We also see more independent items, so free words, becoming more dependent items, such as affixes. So often a free word in the history of the language will become an affix, and the development of negation in the present-day language is exactly a case of this. So not becomes nt, and this nt in the present-day language used to be a free word, and it has become an affix. And there are plenty of examples in the history of English. If you want to find out more, so the prepositions for and till become a special kind of complementizer. For, in particular, is a complementizer that introduces non-finite clauses. So this would be a sentence like, he hoped for Mary to win the race, or George expected for England to win the World Cup, or something like that. You also get verbs have, be, will, and do, and so on, becoming auxiliaries. So these start out as lexical verbs. There is a concrete meaning of have, as in if I say, I have this water bottle, I have it, I own it, I possess it, it's mine. But if you say something like, I have gone to the shops, what do you have? You don't possess anything. This have is a different have. It's an auxiliary. It's a grammatical item. It's used to link sentences together. The preposition like becoming a discourse marker, as we discussed last week, is another case of this. And also the whole development of negation, which we talked about quite extensively, is yet another case. So the change that we referred to as Jespersen's cycle. In Lecture 7, is another important case of grammaticalization, one of the most striking changes of this kind in the history of the language. And if you want to find out more, this textbook by Hopper and Traugott gives an introduction and an overview of what this grammaticalization process is. When you get grammaticalization happening over and over and over again in the history of a language, you get a cycle. So you have essentially history repeating itself. This also is something we see across the world's languages. The same grammaticalization process being found again and again, even multiple times within the history of one language. So here is the negative case. In Old English, we have a negator, ne, that is pre-verbal. It goes in before the finite verb. In Middle English, it finds a new friend. It is joined by a post-verbal negator, nacht or nawicht or something like that. And this is the word that ends up becoming modern English, not. So here we have, for of all his strength, ne dred we nawicht. We dread nothing, literally, in the earliest days. But this nawicht element, it starts out as an emphatic element, a pragmatically marked element, and it develops into a more grammatical element. And what happens then, once it becomes more grammatical, once all it does is express this meaning of negation, then the original negator, the ne, is lost. And that's what we see in the next example from Chaucer. So in this example, there is no ne. The ne is gone. So this represents the next stage, and in fact, the modern stage, because this is what present-day English does as well. As I've said, this change is called Jespersen's cycle, after the man in the photo, Otto Jespersen, famous historian of English, and it's very common across the world's languages. There is a list there of other languages in which this happens, which I will not read out. Moving to our external influences then, what about these language contact influences? Now this timeline, as I've said, this is a very approximate timeline, and I've shown you that some words that come from each of these languages, but it's very important to remember that it's not just words that English recruits from some of these languages. Some of these languages mainly have lexical influence on the history of English, so that's the case for Latin. Latin has a huge influence on the lexicon of English, but almost no influence on any other domain, so almost no influence, let's say, syntactically or morphologically or even phonologically. By contrast, a language like Norse has influence all across the language. So there is morphological influence documented, there is phonological influence documented to some extent, there is syntactic influence as well as lexical influence. And then there are other cases that are in between. So for instance, the case of French and Anglo-Norman in its earliest days, we have endings, morphological endings, that come into the language, but that is pretty much the only area, derivational morphology is pretty much the only area where we get these borrowings in the early history of the language. So that is a nice case where a language has some influence outside the lexical domain, but where its greatest influence is in the lexical domain. And French vocabulary is absolutely massive in English today. As we've seen, some estimates, if you look at the whole vocabulary, it is pretty much damn near 50% of the English vocabulary comes directly from French. And then in more recent years, we have influences from the languages of the people who we, the British Empire, colonized and subjugated. And they got their revenge by giving us lovely words like pajamas. But there is much, much more to be said about the recent influences, and I use recent in the sense of last 300 years around the world. We touched on this at the end of the last lecture. It's not something we'll be able to dwell on in any detail. But later in your course here, you may well get the chance to take a course in varieties of English, which will give you more of a perspective on the different varieties of English spoken around the world. Now, contact is the major language external factor in the history of English, and we can ask ourselves questions like, do different types of language contact lead to different types of change? And Peter Trudgill has one intriguing perspective on this, so you can read his book, or if you like, you can listen to an interview that I did with him back when this book came out, where we talk about some of its implications in a more informal way. In terms of the history of English, we've seen the contact situations with Celtic, Latin, Greek, Norse, and Anglo-Norman, and as we've seen, some of these effects are very clear, and some of them are actually more debated. In particular, the case of Celtic is still heavily debated today. There is still no consensus on just how much of English owes its origin to the Celtic languages that were in the British Isles before English arrived. And so there could well be major grammatical effects from that process. What about standardization then? Well, one thing that we've seen in the development of the language is that before the early modern period, it didn't really make sense to speak of a linguistic standard. So we have a standard. We have a standard today. And if you want to learn English, as you guys are doing, have been doing, you can do it by finding books that describe that language. These represent the process of codification of grammatical properties. But the production of these books, grammars, dictionaries, is something that really only took off in the 17th century and beyond. And so this is quite important. It may be, we don't know what would have happened if there had never been a Norman conquest, let's say, or if before that there had never been a Scandinavian invasion which of the kind that ultimately led Knut, King Knut, of the Scandinavians to rule over England for a brief period at the beginning of the 11th century. If none of that had ever happened, maybe we'd be still speaking something like Old English today. Because Old English had a kind of standard, at least in the sense that we could see that the scribes who were writing in Old English were all writing in a relatively similar way, and that they were influenced by one another. That is to a certain extent lost in the later history of the language. And after that, we have to wait another 600 years before we start getting a standard emerging once again. But this also means that the kind of prescriptivism that we see today is largely something that was invented in the 17th century and later. And this may seem a somewhat counterintuitive conclusion. So what? Really, there wasn't a proper way to speak English before the 17th century? Well, no. There were different varieties, and none was necessarily considered better or worse than any other. This has been the natural state of most languages throughout most of the history of mankind. This kind of prescriptivism that we see today is something that arises during the early modern period, and it's no coincidence that it arises in conjunction with various other developments. It arises in conjunction with the rise, for instance, of the nation state, with the rise of Romanticism, with the rise of what Norbert Elias has called the civilizing process. So this is something really, really important. The way we look at languages, the whole way we think about languages as people in the 21st century is shaped by this development that we consider very natural, but which nevertheless has only characterized a tiny fraction of human history. Now, I'm not saying that people never judged one another before that time, of course. It's another thing that we know about humans is that they will always judge other humans based on how they look, how they dress, how fat they are, how thin they are, how tall they are, how short they are, how male they are, how female they are, etc. Right? People will always judge other people, and it's, in language it's just the same as any other case. But the particular way that we do that, the setting of one particular variety on a pedestal and saying this is the variety beyond all others that we must aspire to, that is something that really only developed in the early modern period across Europe. And it's not a development that's unique to English, of course. We see exactly the same thing happening to, for instance, the Romance languages at exactly the same time. Quick revision here. We saw there's four key processes of standardization. First of all, selection. Selection of a new variety. We need to find which variety we're going to put on that pedestal. We need to elaborate that variety. We need to make sure that it can deal with all of the domains of the language that we need it to domain, so to cope with. So we need it to broaden. We need the lexical range to be such that it can deal with science, it can deal with philosophy, it can deal with all of these highfalutin domains. We need to codify the language, so we need dictionaries, we need grammars, we need documents that people can refer to for learning the language. And then finally, we need to accept, we need to get the population to accept that this is the variety that people use. And this last process is perhaps the most remarkable of all, because in the present day, you can see very easily how the media is able to indoctrinate people by spreading the same old bullshit day in and day out across the entire country, across the entire world. But before the advent of mass media, the idea that you could get an entire population to settle on one linguistic variety, it's quite an amazing feat of social engineering when you really think about it. All right, so one of the big questions here is whether prescriptivism actually leads to the language itself changing. Well, it certainly affects written output. It's been documented that if you look at preposition stranding, this goes down. So if you remember when we talked about early modern English, preposition stranding is something that has always been there in the English language. But in the 17th century and beyond, certain individuals decided that this was an unpleasant feature, a feature that the language should not have, and they started campaigning against its use. And they did have an effect. So when you look at the written texts, you see that preposition stranding gets much, much rarer. Now, the real question is that an effect of actually, is this actually affecting the language, or is this just affecting the output, right? So one question that we can observe is throughout, whenever we're looking at the history of a language, is to what extent do the written text really represent the language as it was spoken, as it was known, right? So if you look at the present day English language, what you will find is that there are certain words that almost never appear in texts. So for instance, you don't find all that many uses of the word fuck, especially in formal registers, and even less cunt, and there are some words that are even less used than those. That's not because they're not part of the language, right? That's completely for other reasons. So written documents aren't always a good reflection of what's going on in a language. And so it could be that people, when people are using less preposition stranding, it's not because it's somehow atrophying in their grammar, it's just because they're making an effort to make their writing more normalized, to use less preposition stranding, even though it's still perfectly grammatical for them. And as you can see, despite three centuries of prescription, of proscription against preposition stranding, people trying to get people not to do it, it's still alive in the language today. So sometimes people say that this prescriptivism is like trying to dam a river and failing. I would go a bit further. It's like saying I'm going to put a bit of tissue paper in a river and try and dam it with that. Right? I think it's a really futile attempt trying to get a whole language to change prescriptively in this way. That's not to say that prescriptivism might not have effects. So if you throw tissue paper into a river, it might still have an effect. It might go and clog up someone's stream further down the river. So prescriptivism might have effects that were not the intended ones, and that is an intriguing possibility. And again, there's a book here that deals with this in some detail, Anne Curzon's book, Fixing English. This, again, is in the Semesterapparat, or should be, or will be. In the meantime, there's an audio interview, again, that I did with her when this book came out, that gives you some detail about what the book is about without going into all of the nitty-gritty details. Finally, an important message. This is something I tried to hammer home last time. What happens with the English language from now on is entirely up to you. It's entirely up to you and all of the rest of the people who use English worldwide. We cannot assume that things will go on as they have always been going. With the political changes that we see in the world, with the changes in how people live their lives that we see with the millennial generation, we might well see big changes in the English language and how you react to those, how you deal with those in your teaching, how you deal with those in your everyday life and in your own usage is up to you. So choose wisely. Okay, that is it as far as the big themes of the course are concerned that I wanted to give an overview of. Does anyone have any burning questions? How do you grade the exam is the question. Okay, so the grading of the exam, there are 36 questions, they're multiple choice, each one has a right answer and a wrong answer, so you get a mark out of 36, and then we have a cunning secret algorithm that converts that into the grade that you will receive. I can't say any more about that, because the reason I can't say anything more about it is because it's actually quite complicated, but if you go digging around in the Prüfungsordnungen, you can actually find the answer to that. So basically, you get a mark out of 36, which is then converted into a numerical grade of the usual kind, 1, 1,3, 1,7, 2, 2,3, 2,7, 3, 3,3, 3,7, 4, 5. Right. Where what you really don't want to get is a 5. That's a really good question. So the question is, we know that Old English has this verb second type rule, and that there are some exceptions to this, and the question is, we also know that Old English has a negator, ne, which comes before the verb, and the question is, how does that interact with our rule? How does that interact with our verb second rule? The answer is that it actually doesn't at all. So the ne, you can treat it as if it's not there, basically. It's invisible for the purposes of counting constituents, which probably indicates that it's actually more of an affix than it is a separate word. In the text, it's usually written as a separate word, but again, it's probably more of an affix. So if you have, for instance, an object and then the negation and then the verb, that still is a verb second sentence. That still counts as a verb second sentence. So the negation is kind of invisible for word order purposes. Great question. More questions like that, please. So here are some resources that you can use for your revision. And it's probably best if you use a combination of these things. So you have a week now to do this revision. You've got lecture slides. They're all available in ILIAS. They're available in handout form and in slide in big form. You've got the recordings, which our Kim team have been so wonderfully generous to provide. And I think we should give them a small round of applause for doing so, because Kirthika has been here every single week and reliably recording. So. And thank you also for the editing work that goes on behind the scenes, because that also is not trivial. So thanks for that. We've also got a textbook, and the textbook is a great source because the textbook put things one way, I put things a different way, and sometimes you need to hear things in two different voices in order for it to make sense. So do make sure that you take a look at the textbook as well as what I'm saying. Now, for the avoidance of doubt, nothing that's in the textbook but not in the slides will be covered on the exam. So what is in the slides is what is going to be covered in the exam. But nevertheless, like I say, because the textbook puts things differently, you might want to read the textbook anyway, because it will give you a different perspective on the issues that might help you to consolidate your knowledge. On ILIAS, there is a sample exam, so you can have a look at that. You can read it, and you can practice it, and then you can look at the answers, which are also there, and you can try and solve the puzzle of why you got the thing wrong in the first place. The other thing that you can use for revision for the history of English is what's on the internet, because there's a huge amount out there, and by now, you at least ought to have the critical thinking skills that enable you to distinguish complete nonsense from good linguistic resources. So look around. If you want, particularly for Old English, there are some lovely little resources out there. You can go on YouTube and listen to people pronouncing Old English poetry. You can find beautiful sheets of morphological endings. For Middle English, you can go and read some Chaucer, which is interesting in its own right as a literary work, and so on and so forth. There's plenty of material that you can use that is out there beyond the domain of what I've given you in this course. Finally, of course, I'm here and our tutors are here, my office hours are Mondays 3 till 4, Wednesdays 11:30 till 12:30. There's only two of those between now and the exam, so be careful. Show up in advance in order to make sure that you don't miss out. You can also email us, but here there is a caveat, which is if we get a panicky email at midnight on the night before the exam, we reserve the right not to answer it, okay? Also, if you ask us a question that doesn't make any sense, we reserve the right to answer it. If you want to ask us a question that doesn't make any sense, the best thing to do is come to the tutorial or to my office hours, because then I can't avoid answering it because you're right there. So if you want to ask a question by email, by all means go ahead, but make sure you carefully think about how you phrase it and make sure that there it has, it's something that I will not choose to ignore. And that's not because I'm mean, it's because there are 150 of you, and if you all email me every day, I'm going to get extremely sick of it. So be careful with your emails. So if you fail the exam this year, this summer, then there will be another one at the beginning of the second semester, or at the beginning of next semester. Right. So usually we have that in the first week of the new semester. There's a second chance to do the exam and to do it again. So that is an option. I wouldn't have it like 2-3 weeks before the so it would be either the week that the lectures start or the week before the week that the lectures start. So that would be when we'll have the resit exam. It depends how many people there are, and it depends what happens. Hopefully, not all that many people will actually fail the exam. It doesn't usually happen that many people do. So don't worry about that. I mean, ultimately, if you want that not to happen, then revise, right? But you know that already. So the question is, in the sample exam, there's a table with all of the pronouns and everything like that for Old English. Will that be there in the actual exam? Yes, it will, right? So take a deep breath and chill, because you will have those morphological paradigms just like in the sample exam. Okay, so here I thought we'd just briefly spend another 20 minutes or so talking about some interesting features, and I'm going to do something different now, which is I'm going to ask you to point out to me some of the linguistic features of this text, some of the interesting things that set the early modern English text apart from the modern English text. So this is a text that there have been many, many translations of over the years. It's called The Consolation of Philosophy by Boethius, a 6th century Italian. He was living at the time when Italy was ruled by the Goths, and the Goths had put him in prison, so he was not a very happy man. And he wrote this text, and it was very, very influential on later Christianity. But that's just the general background. What I want you to do is tell me some interesting things about the linguistic features of what's going on here in this text. Right, so here we have mutability this is our final word, and this mutability is spelt with an IE. So we can see there's an orthographic change, and what do we probably want to say about this ending, this ability ending? Any ideas about where this comes from? Yes, it's a suffix from French. So this is an ending. If you know a bit of French, you know they have these endings like habilité, and this is one of those particular endings that comes in during the Middle English period and beyond to give the English language some of the weird morphological endings that it has today. Okay, good. So we've got some spelling variation, some lexical variation. What can you tell me about verb endings? Are there any interesting verb endings? Yeah. So in the first line, we have thinkest, right? We have this German-style ST second-person singular ending, which is one of the last surviving endings. This is one of the most robust endings in the history of the language because it survives all the way up until the King James Bible and beyond. It's really quite recent that we lose this ST and the pronoun that goes with it, which is thou. So also this second person pronoun, thou, is also lost during this period. Yeah, so this also, deceived, is another French loan. Yeah. And often you can tell from the orthography, because you have particular combinations of vowels that make it look particularly French. Here, this is a U that is standing in for a V. This orthographically is something else that we see quite consistently in this early modern period. So can you see any V's at all in this text? So ever, this word ever, which would have been pronounced ever during this period as well, the letter V, the modern letter V, is not used here. The modern letter V really only comes in later, and during this period, the letter V is only used at the beginning of words where it's used at all. However, there are many texts where we simply don't find it because there aren't any words that begin with V, and that is the case here. So we just don't find any V's in this text. So that's one spelling feature. We just find a U where we would expect a V earlier. What else? There's another interesting verbal ending in this text, a third person ending. Yeah, so here we have she hath. So hath rather than has. This again is one of the few endings that survives. The competition between th and sir is a rather sad story, because what actually happens in the history of the language is that is with th and sir, the sir and is there in Northumbrian Old English. So it's there in the 10th century. And up until about the 18th century, the th and the sir ending are still fighting it out. But by now, by the present day in which we live, th has finally died. Th has finally given up the fight. So we only have sir. And it's interesting that if you look at a text like this, I'm not sure what the generalization is in this text, but if you look at texts by Shakespeare, what you will often see is that some specific verbs retain the th ending, but all of the normal verbs, all of the regular lexical verbs, have the s ending. So you find variation within an individual text. Okay, so this is the early modern version. This is Queen Elizabeth I's version. There's a picture of her. I never get tired of pointing out how badass Queen Elizabeth I is. I think if we have to go back in time to a really awesome British monarch, this is the one. You know, Queen Victoria, yeah, she had a long reign and all of that, but ultimately it's all about Queen Elizabeth I. Ginger as well, showing that people with red hair can be just as successful and just as productive as the rest of society. All right, so here is Chaucer's translation of exactly the same text. So here we've got a different version of the exactly the same text. Tell me about this. Tell me about what linguistic features we find. Verb second, where do we find verb second? Yes, so this is you think that fortune. This is verb second. It's also subject verb, so it's no different from what we would see in the present day language either. So actually from that particular example, we can't really tell whether the verb second rule is in operation or not, even though the sentence itself is verb second. Remember that a modern English sentence like John loves Mary is also verb second. So we need to make a distinction between the verb second rule and the verb second in terms of a linear property of individual sentences. Which direct object? Second, in the changing of herself. That one is actually a definite article. So the other one is an object. So you were right, there is there as an object. For instance, in the second line, you think that fortune be changed against thee. So this is the thee pronoun in Middle English. So it's thee, it's a familiar form. Remember, there is during this period, there is a difference between familiar second-person pronouns and polite second-person pronouns. This is Boethius talking to the spirit of philosophy, and they're clearly on familiar terms because they just use thou all the time. And thee, which is the familiar form of the object. What's interesting here is that you actually see, as far as the endings are concerned, you see a combination of French words with old English-type endings. So you see the word stableness. Stable is a borrowing, actually, from French. Ness is an ending from Old English. So stableness, stability, you're taking a French word and adding an English ending. Similarly, changing, the change part, the stem, is from French, and the ing is from Old English. So you can see a mixture here of different languages within the same text. And Chaucer is, this is something I've mentioned before, Chaucer himself was very conscious of which words came from French and which ones came from English, and he would play with these words. He would be creative, he would use words in a specific way to represent social classes. So one of his texts, The Parliament of Fowls, it's a satirical text with a parliament that's made up of birds. And in this parliament, some of the more high-class birds speak using lots of French words. And the kind of the regular birds, like the sparrows and the pigeons, I guess, I can't remember which birds exactly are in it, those guys use more English words. So there's a clear consciousness of the social variation that comes with the linguistic variation during this period. Again, an illustration that even before standardization, people would judge each other based on the language they were using. Yes, very good. We see reflexive forms, real reflexive forms arising. So we've got herself in the bottom row. In Old English, we don't see reflexives. We don't see these forms with self used as reflexives. This is something that emerges, well, during the late Old English period and also during the modern English period. So the reflexives really emerge during this time. Good observation. How are we doing for time? Okay, one more step back in time. So, all right, now it's getting serious. We've got some West Saxon Old English, translation of exactly the same text. This translation is usually been said to have been written by King Alfred himself. So this is really one of these things where in the early history of English, everyone who was anyone translated this text. You've got Elizabeth I, you've got Chaucer, and then you've got King Alfred the Great. Of course, we don't actually know whether he really translated that or whether he just got some monks to do it for him, right? He was a king after all. You could say the same about Queen Elizabeth to an extent. But regardless, here we have a piece of Old English text which says exactly the same thing as the text that we've seen before from Middle and Early Modern English. So, tell me things about this text. Tell me what you can see in this text. A different alphabet, yeah. So, what respects do we see the alphabet differing in here? The ash in front of it, that's the thorn in front of the U. So, in the first line we have thu, and this is the ev. This is the thorn. So we've seen this thorn before. This thorn is not part of the Latin alphabet. Where does it come from? It's runic, yes. It comes from the elder Futhark and the younger Futhork runic alphabet. So this thorn comes from the runes. Of these particular characters that you see here, that's the only one that comes from the runes. You see these other special characters as well. Ev, yes, this is our Ev, and then we see Ash, yes. So we've seen Thorn, Ev, and Ash. This one comes from runic. These ones come from Latin alphabet characters that have been written a little bit differently. So this is literally just a weird D, and this is just literally a weird A and a weird E written together. So although these are special to the Old English alphabet, they are formed from original Latin alphabet characters, unlike the thorn, which comes from the runes. Good. And you see that there's some variation here, because this word thu, the second person pronoun, is sometimes spelt with the thorn, and sometimes it's spelt with the ev. So there is just variation between those two characters. What else can you tell me about this text? It uses Old English personal pronouns, yes. That in itself is not hugely surprising in an Old English text. Can you be more specific? Yes. So this is, you can tell it's Old English because it has pronouns like thou, for instance. What other pronouns do we find in this text? This actually is So that Z is actually not a pronoun. It looks like the German pronoun Z, but it's actually related very closely to a different German word that you might be familiar with, well, that you will be familiar with, you'll speak German. So this is a cognate of the German word sei, which is a form of what mood? Konjunktiv, right? This is a Konjunktiv 1. And the Konjunktiv 1, I probably know this stuff better than you do because I had it drilled into me at school, whereas you guys just know this stuff naturally by being German native speakers. You lucky buggers. So this is something else we can see. This Z form, S-I-E, is a subjunctive form. It's a subjunctive form because the Old English has a robust subjunctive. And the subjunctive in Old English expresses irrealis. Okay, so here we can also say there are other pronouns here that are particularly Old English. Can anyone spot them? Ah, so there's the symbol for and that looks like a seven. Yeah, that's another orthographic feature of Old English that's quite special. It's called the Tyronean et. And it shouldn't look quite as much like a seven as it does here. That's just me being lazy and using a seven. But it does look, it does have this seven-like, it's something like that, right? Actually, that's just a seven as well, isn't it? Never mind. So what I wanted to point out was the pronouns, because if you look at the pronouns in the at the bottom here, you've got a hy, he. That's a third-person plural pronoun. Here, in this text, fortune is referred to not in the singular, but in the plural, in the third-person plural. You can also see that in the verb agreement. These on verb endings, they are also plural endings, plural past indicative endings. In the exam, you will have the list of paradigms, so you'll be able to look stuff up like this. You've got he and you've got hiora in particular. Hiora is the form that is later replaced by the pronoun there with a the, which comes from where? From Norse, yeah, from Scandinavian. Any other features of this text? There are some cases of breaking here. They look a bit different. So beheldon, for instance. Beheldon, beheld, or literally beheld. Here there is breaking because you've got an L before a consonant, and that is the context in which breaking takes place. So this E-O-L-D, that is your breaking environment. So remember these major Old English changes. There will be questions about this on the exam. Breaking, palatalization, iumlaut. Yes, in the fourth line, ert. Yes, the last word on the fourth line, that's another case of breaking. Good. Yeah, so we can see some instances of breaking there. You're getting good at this, or at least some of you are. The ones who spoke, the ones who are silent, you can take inspiration from the great works and deeds of your comrades, and you can do some revision. And hopefully, by this time next week, you will be here, you will be able to absolutely nail it. So, that is it from me. Thank you very much for attending the course, and yeah.